Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. Today, we are in part two of our conversation about the state judiciary. Today, our guest is Mark Rechtenwald. He's the Chief Justice of the Hawaii State Supreme Court. He's the highest judiciary official in our state. Last Sunday morning, we listened to a rebroadcast of part of an interview with Associate Justice Sabrina McKenna from 2011 to get some of the basics of the judiciary system and including a look at her and her life and career. And we also spent about 10 minutes on the interview with Chief Justice Rechtenwald, hearing about his career, hearing about the responsibilities of the Chief Justice and the responsibilities of the courts, also their work in drug court and HOPE probation programs that are intended to help solve the problems that bring people into court, not just sentence them, put them in jail, and have them come back again. Island Issues is on the radio on Hawaii Island every Sunday morning, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. And you may also listen to Island Issues as a podcast, and I urge you to go back and listen to last week's to get more information about Chief Justice Rechtenwald, lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com, and then click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. Chief Justice Rechtenwald and I recorded this conversation several weeks ago when he was here on Hawaii Island. As we rejoined the conversation, I had just asked him about the courthouses in Hilo and in Kona.
The Hilo Courthouse predated my time as Chief Justice, so that was Chief Justice Ronald Moon, my predecessor, who was instrumental in working with the legislature to get that built. But the Kona Courthouse has been very much something that I've been involved in, although, as you well know, Sherry, it's been an idea that's been around for anywhere from 20 to 30 years by some accounts. Absolutely needed. You know, our courthouses are spread in three different locations, in buildings that weren't designed to be courthouses. We're here now in the old Kona Hospital. Judge Ibarra, who's the chief judge of the circuit, was born in this very building, and the nursery was a room where now we have boxes and files. And, you know, it just wasn't structured in a way to be efficient, practical, and secure as a courthouse. So we really needed this courthouse, and we're very grateful for the legislature for funding it. It was $90 million for construction. The Big Island delegation was unanimous in their support. East side, west side, all came together, worked very, very hard over a period of years. And the folks on the Finance and Ways and Means Committees, Chair Luke, Chair Takuda, and Governor Ige were all very supportive. And we're so grateful we broke ground in October. And I just drove by there this morning, and we're making a lot of progress in getting the site ready for construction, looking to open it in 2019.
How are judges and justices selected?
Well, Hawaii has what's called a merit-based system. So back in 1978, we had a constitutional convention which really sort of structured the current system that we have here in Hawaii. So for selection of judges, we have a group called the Judicial Selection Commission, which has 9 members appointed from various places in the community, 2 from the House, 2 from the Senate, 2 from the governor, 1 from me, and 2 from the bar, a mixture of lawyers and non-lawyers. Those folks review all the applications of people who want to become judges, conduct detailed interviews of them, talk to resource people in the community who are familiar with their work, and then come up with a list of names to submit to either the governor for the circuit court or appellate court positions, or to me for the district court and family court positions. And then the governor or I reviews that list. In my case, I interview all of the applicants who are on the list and then make a decision on one of those individuals. That person then goes before the Senate for a confirmation vote. When a judge comes to the end of his or her term, they apply back to that Judicial Selection Commission. The commission reviews the performance evaluations. We have a confidential system for attorneys to be able to evaluate judges. The commission reviews those evaluations, reviews evaluations done by the Hawaii State Bar Association, evaluations by jurors, interviews the candidate, interviews other resource people in the community who are familiar with their work, and also reviews decisions up on appeal and anything else that might be relevant, and makes a decision whether to renew that judge for another term. Our judges serve anywhere from 6 to 10-year terms, so when they come to the end of the term, they apply to that commission to be renewed for another term.
Why is it set up that the governor appoints some and you appoint some?
I'm not sure. I think it was more of just a history or tradition, I think, in that instance. I think it is very beneficial because at least one benefit one might think is that as the Chief Justice I'm familiar with, the folks who are practicing in our courts. I might know up-and-coming attorneys whose names are not as well known by reputation. And in picking for the district court and family court, which are the six-year terms, we have a lot of folks who start in those courts and then move up to the circuit court or appellate court, that I would be able to identify folks who are and have an understanding of who might be the sort of up-and-comers, the people who, you know, are 10, 15, 20 years into their careers. They might not be known statewide, but they might have a really strong reputation, and I could hopefully pick those people and get the right people in and become part of our system of judges and learning how to be a good judge.
Some states have elected judges. We do not, and I'd like your opinion on whether that's a good or bad thing.
Yeah, I think there are real concerns with electing judges. There actually was a proposal for elected judges last year at the legislature. There was overwhelming opposition to that proposal, and it was defeated. The reason, in a nutshell, is when judges run for office, they have to fundraise. And I think the role of fundraising and seeking campaign contributions from the community is in many ways fundamentally incompatible with what judges are supposed to do, which is to be independent, to decide cases in front of them based on the law. When we talk about judicial independence, that's what it means. The judge decides the case based on the law, based on the facts, and not with regard to who that person is, whether they're powerful or not, whether they donated money to their campaign or not. And when you begin introducing the factor of the judge campaigning and having to raise money, inevitably there's a concern that that action of raising money is going to somehow compromise the judge's independence. And there are many states that do have that system, and they try to insulate the judge from it by having campaign committees and the like, but I think it still has that effect of causing judges to think more about the political implications of decisions rather than what's right or wrong based on the law. And the other thing I'd point out, in all of those states, there's also the influence of PAC money or super PAC money. And in fact, there have been attempts to influence judicial elections by very well-financed organizations that might have a particular point of view and would come in and put a lot of money into a judicial race. So that, again, I think can really affect the independence of the system and ultimately the fairness of the system. It has the potential for doing that, and that's why it's a real concern.
Justice Rechtenwald, this question comes out of the fact that I note that we have several fairly recently appointed judges here on Hawaii Island, and when Judge Ronald Ibarra retires somewhere, I think, mid-2017, there's going to be at least one more. So you're in charge of all the judges. How do the judges get mentored and monitored, and how do they learn to be great judges? Because even if they're great attorneys, being a judge is certainly a different kind of job.
You know, it's a great question, and we take it very seriously. So I think a key aspect, I think as in any profession, is mentoring. So we assign a mentor to every new judge whose task it is to ensure that that judge is learning what they need to learn, progressing, has someone that they can talk to bounce issues off of. I think that's also the responsibility of the chief judge of the court where those new judges sit. And I think Chief Judge Ibarra is a great example of that. He's a fantastic judicial mentor. I think he meets regularly with our new judge, all of the judges here in the Third Circuit, but a great example for them. And then the other things that we do, we have, you know, resources for the judges, bench books that talk about or sort of set forth the law and the procedure in particular areas. We have statewide judicial training, typically twice a year, where all of our judges come together for a day. We bring in speakers from sometimes outside the state, sometimes from here, to address issues that are current and of concern in the courts. And that really gives the judges a chance to talk to each other as well. And we do online training for them. So throughout the year, we'll have, you know, two-hour web-based training for all of our judges. And then we have the opportunity to send judges to what's called the National Judicial College up in Reno, which is a judicial training institute. And we fund for every new judge at least one trip up to Reno so they can have that opportunity to get formal training for a week or 2 weeks, whatever the course might be. So we have a very good judicial education program, a great committee, which actually Judge Ibarra chairs, that works hard to come up with the training tools and information that our judges need.
Justice Rechtenwald, I think most people know that the federal Supreme Court has the discretion to accept or not accept a case, to hear or not hear a case. Does the Hawaii Supreme Court have that same opportunity?
For the most part, our approach is very similar to that of the U.S. Supreme Court. So the vast majority of the cases that come before us are coming from our Intermediate Court of Appeals. So we have a three-level system in Hawaii. trial courts, the intermediate court, appellate court, and everyone has the right to appeal to that court and at least have one level of appeal. And then the appeals to us are discretionary. So we have the ability to decide whether or not the issues in a case are important enough, there's enough of a conflict or uncertainty of the law to take that case and try to clarify the law in that area, which is very much what the U.S. Supreme Court does. Now, we do have some areas where cases can come to us directly. There was just a law passed that provides for certain appeals and contested case hearings to come directly to the Hawaii Supreme Court. There's also a process for cases that are in the Intermediate Court of Appeals when there's certain types of issues involved to be transferred to us. So there are exceptions, but the general rule is that we have the discretion to decide what cases to accept.
When a case is appealed up to the Supreme Court to you, are you looking at whether proper procedure was followed, or are you looking again at the facts of a case? What is it that the Supreme Court actually is adjudicating?
It's a great question, and I think, you know, a lot of folks who see courts on television, they're typically seeing trial courts, and so they see evidence being taken, jurors reviewing that evidence, or judges reviewing the evidence. What our job is to decide whether the procedure that was followed followed the law, and whether the outcome is supported by the law or facts. So we don't retry the case. We don't take evidence in our court. We review what we call the record, which is, you know, you see the court reporter in the background taking down everything that's said during the course of trial. That gets turned into a transcript. That, plus all the exhibits, plus all of the pleadings that the parties submitted in the trial court, all that comes up to us, and we review it based on, with the starting point being the party's opportunity to submit briefs to us explaining what they think the trial court did wrong. So in essence, when the case comes up to us, the suggestion is the trial court should have done something differently. It should have admitted a certain piece of evidence, not admitted that evidence, should have suppressed some evidence in a criminal case, instructed the jury incorrectly on what the law was. And there are cases in which the argument will be that the evidence just did not support the verdict. And that's a very high standard to meet, and that happens. But those cases can come up that challenge the insufficiency of the evidence. But we're not trying the evidence, or we're not going to try the case again ourselves. We're looking to see whether, based on the record, there was enough evidence there to support whatever the ultimate judgment was. So typically the outcome for us, we may affirm the trial court. We may send the case back to be retried again if we think there was an error in the procedure. And there are occasions when, based on the record, we'll simply reach a different result and say the outcome should be a different one from what the trial court said.
That's kind of interesting to me, because that sort of sounds like if I don't like the answer I got at a lower court, I can just keep on going until I get the answer I want.
Absolutely. And we're the court of last resort in the state of Hawaii, so that when you get to us, that is the last appeal, with one exception. So in the Hawaii state courts, again, we have trial courts. If someone's unhappy with the outcome, with the way that trial went, they have an appeal as of right to our Intermediate Court of Appeals, and then discretionary appeal to us at the Hawaii Supreme Court. And we are the court of last resort on questions of Hawaii law. So one exception is if there's a federal law issue, and we can have federal issues come up in state cases, there is a right to appeal. There is a discretionary review by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is why on occasion you will see cases from the Hawaii Supreme Court that end up, or other state Supreme Courts that end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. For us, it's rather rare. It might be every couple of years that the U.S. Supreme Court would actually accept a case from Hawaii that we ruled on because it raised a question of federal law.
Well, that brings up the question of if there's a conflict between federal and state law, how do you look at it as justices?
Well, the federal law governs. You know, there's a supremacy clause in the Constitution. We apply federal law, so we're obligated to apply federal law. And if it conflicts directly with the federal law is going to govern in that situation. There also are times when there's an argument that even though there's not a direct conflict between the federal law and state law, that the federal government or the federal Congress has intended to what's called preempt an entire area of the law and preclude states from even attempting to legislate in that area. That's a very complex issue, comes up sometimes, but generally speaking, you know, we're a court that's a part of the United States judicial system. We're obligated to uphold the federal laws and Constitution.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. We're talking today with Hawaii State Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwald, who's the top dog of all the judiciary in this state. All the judges work for him and all the courts report to him. Part one of our conversation with both Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Associate Justice Sabrina McKenna aired last Sunday, and you may hear that and other Island Issues interviews online, lava1053.com or koacountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. For next Sunday morning, I'm heading over to Volcano this week. We'll get an update on Kilauea Volcano from the scientists at Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, and also an update on what's going on with Mauna Loa, not just how it's doing and, you know, whether they see an eruption in the foreseeable future, but how they're preparing for that eventuality, because if and when Mauna Loa erupts, it's going to be perhaps an even bigger deal than Kilauea. For that one, please join us on the radio next Sunday morning here on Hawaii Island, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country 107.7 FM, 8 a.m. Lava 105.3 FM. Now, back to Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwald in a talk story we recorded several weeks ago in the Kona Courthouse. I wanted to ask you a question about what I personally would call separation of powers. That may not be the right term. My understanding is that the legislature makes the laws, and then the court may interpret those laws as necessary. But I've heard people say, for example, in cases of really complicated ballot initiatives, oh, it doesn't really make any difference because it'll go to the court. The court will decide what the law is. So talk about that issue. I mean, is that your job to actually essentially make laws or what?
Well, it's a very complex issue. And I think the point of view that most judges would say is that when there's a statute, our obligation is to determine what the intent of the legislature was and to implement that intent. And typically we will do that by starting with the plain language of the statute and trying to decide. And if it is unambiguous based on the plain language, that really is the end of our discussion. We're looking at what did the legislature write in this law, what did they want? And the law itself obviously is a great place to start for that analysis. Now, if there's a result which is simply absurd, you know, it appears there was a typo, the word no was inserted somewhere where it shouldn't have been, there are cases where we might grant relief in that situation. But generally speaking, start with the plain language and then go to the legislative history if there's some ambiguity in the actual statute to try to determine what the intent of the legislature was. Now, sometimes there are areas of the law where terms will be undefined. There'll be areas where it might appear that it's contemplated that the courts will be developing, or through judicial decisions or the work of administrative agencies, the law will be refined over periods of time. So that is something that can happen in our judicial system. But generally speaking, I think you got it right, which is the role of the legislature is to define the law, set the law, create the law. Our role is to interpret it and, of course, to determine constitutional rights as well and determine the constitutionality of a statute, which is an issue that comes up, and also to determine the impact on individual rights that might be implicated under our Constitution.
You know, when you talk about plain language, I sometimes think the state legislature could use a little more plain language because I don't understand a lot of the stuff they do.
Well, I've had the opportunity to work in legislatures, and it can be a very challenging job. So in writing a statute, you have sometimes a desire to be very, very specific and cover every possible circumstance, or the other direction that you can draft the statute is to be rather general and then expect that there will be development in the law over time. I think our legislature works very, very hard to draft good bills. And I think anytime you're trying to address a very complex area of behavior where you're not sure what's going to happen or what issues are going to come up, it really raises challenges to be able to get that right balance between specificity and generality. But I think our legislature works really hard to do that.
I understand that in some cases, Hawaii law is more stringent, more protective of the rights of the accused than federal law. For example, I've been told that consent searches at the airport, Hawaii law will absolutely prohibit that from being done, or allowing police to search the bags of people who are taken into the police station under arrest. So a question is, should Hawaii law be more consistent with federal law? Is there a reason our laws appear to restrict the police more than in other areas?
It's a great question. And I think generally speaking, and we're talking now about typically about rights of criminal defendants, regarding search and seizure, questioning by police, and the like. The federal constitution, in essence, sets the floor. It establishes protections which states cannot undercut or go below in their approach in their cases, but states have the right and the ability to provide greater protections beyond what the federal constitution does. And so we've done that in Hawaii, as you pointed out, on occasion. There are various reasons for that. One is that although our state constitution tracks the federal constitution in many ways, there are provisions that are unique to our constitution in this area. The right to privacy, for example, there's an express right to privacy in the Hawaii constitution that has to be taken into account in balancing or trying to determine what the correct analysis is in a particular situation. And then again, in applying our constitutional provisions, even where the language is similar to the federal constitution, we may, over the course of time, develop a different perspective on the importance of a particular provision, on the need to deter particular types of conduct through interpreting those provisions in a given way. And so over time, I think we, as each issue comes up, we decide the question of, are we going to apply, in essence, what the federal constitution applies, or is this a situation where a greater right is needed here in Hawaii?
I've been told that one area of concern for police departments and prosecutors is that they often have to use mainland labs for DNA testing because our DNA testing lab on Oahu at the Honolulu Police Department is incredibly backed up. And so they have said that means they have an expense to fly the expert witnesses here to testify because I guess those folks have to appear in person. Is there a solution to that kind of thing that would keep that kind of cost down so using a mainland lab and getting faster turnaround in some cases might be more practical? Can there be a way for folks to testify by video, or is that not a practical solution?
Well, it's a great question, a really complicated one. And what I'll do is I'll assume that the particular type of issue that we're talking about is one where there's live testimony is required. In other words, it's a type of issue where there needs to be a right to confront the witness. And that's really what drives the question of whether the person can testify by video or not, because under both the federal and state of Hawaii constitutions, there's a right to confront the witnesses against you. Generally, that's been interpreted as a right to confront witnesses face to face. Now, there are situations where there's been some variation from that. The most notable has been in cases involving child sexual assault, where both the United States and Hawaii decisions have allowed limited use of video testimony in cases involving very young children, where the questioning can take place in one area and be observed by the jury in another room. So the victim is not, or the complaining witness is not in the same room as the defendant, is rather in another room, for example, where there would be a camera, the prosecuting attorney, the defense lawyer conducting the questioning, and then the jury and the defendant are able to watch that proceeding by video. So I think what's been recognized is those are unique situations, they're very compelling interests that drive the decision to not go with what's the general preference, which is face-to-face testimony. Generally speaking, cost has not been something that the courts have said is a sufficient consideration to allow a variation or allow something less than face-to-face confrontation. Although there have been bills in our legislature to allow, for example, mainland victims in certain types of crimes, property crimes, for example. So tourists who come here might get something stolen from their car, go back to the mainland. Could they be allowed to testify by video? So far, those bills haven't been advanced because these kinds of questions have come up.
Chief Justice Rechtenwald, what do you want to continue to improve about the court system here in the state, or especially here on Hawaii Island? What are your key items?
Getting the Kona Courthouse up and operating, I think, is a critical priority. Continuing to enhance public safety through programs like HOPE Probation, Drug Court, and one that I'm very excited about is our Veterans Treatment Court. So that's, again, an intensive program where veterans who come into the criminal justice system, while their case is pending, we assign them to this court, and there's a team, again, of people who are responsible for trying to address whatever that is that brought them into that court and caused them to violate the law. So we have social workers, we could have psychological counseling, we can have any kind of whatever the issue is, try to address it, substance abuse counseling. And the two things about it that are really important, one is that we have the Veterans Administration at the table as part of that team. And what we had found before we set this court up is we were not systematically identifying veterans, and we were not, therefore, hooking them up with services which they had earned through their service to this country, where they might have been eligible for certain types of medical care or training or counseling, that we just weren't identifying them and hooking them up with those services at the VA. So we have the VA at the table as part of the team that's working with that veteran. And then we have mentors, so people who are veterans themselves who can basically lend a sympathetic ear to that person, help them navigate what they need to do if they're homeless, to try to help them navigate getting back into housing, help them deal with issues of getting medical coverage. And it's been a fantastic, fantastic initiative. We opened it on Oahu a couple years ago. Judge Ibarra and Judge Nakamura have opened it here on this island, both in Kona and in Hilo. I had a graduate from this side a couple months ago, and it's really, really exciting. So again, what we're trying to do is find ways to keep the public safe and use our resources in an intelligent way in the criminal justice system to really try to change that root behavior, try to figure out what it is that brought this person into the system and change it so when they come out of the system, they're not going to recidivate again.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking, we always hear the courts are really backed up. Maybe that's a way to reduce it, but it sounds like the process you go through in those kinds of alternate courts is actually a little more time consuming than perhaps a regular court. But let's get back to the issue. Are the courts backed up? If they are, what's the solution?
Obviously, justice delayed is justice denied. So we pay very, very close attention to what our timing is and how cases are moving forward. So on the criminal side, we have a rule in this state that requires cases to come to trial in 180 days. There are reasons why that clock can be tolled. For example, if the defendant is still conducting an investigation, if the prosecution can't get a critical witness, the judge can, in essence, exclude periods of time. But there is a very set process for ensuring that criminal trials get to trial in a timely manner. On the civil side, we have a set of civil rules which have deadlines for when things have to occur. Here on the Big Island, Judge Ibarra is a great leader. He and his judges are reviewing the caseloads to try to figure out where are there delays, where are things backing up, what do we need to do to move those cases, and how do we move them forward. So they're doing a great job. But sometimes we have just a growth in terms of the number of cases in a particular area. This year, for example, we're going to go into the legislature and we're going to seek three additional judge positions, one for district court on Maui. We haven't added a district judge there since the mid-80s. The population has doubled in that period of time. In our family court on Oahu, where we have judges with astronomical caseloads, you know, thousands and thousands of cases that they're responsible for, and then another family court judge on Kauai. And I think there'll come a time down the road where we'll be looking at whether we need an additional judge here in Kona. The problem is we don't have a place to put that judge until we get that new courthouse built. So we try to look at and try to manage that issue in a variety of different ways to make sure that we're deciding cases in a timely manner.
Well, you know, when you said there's a 180-day limit on criminal cases, that also speaks to why sometimes the prosecutors don't charge somebody with a crime until they know they can get it done within 180 days.
I think generally, you know, and I can't speak to what their practice is. That's, again, something that typically we don't get involved in. But the law does allow for periods of time to be excluded from that calculation when there's good cause for it. But a good cause is not like, well, I'm really busy. You know, that typically is not the kind of thing we're looking for. It has to be a very specific reason. You know, this witness, we've tried multiple times to serve the witness. We cannot find them. Here's our plan. And we ask that we have a continuance of a month and that time be excluded. In that period of time, we're going to go to the following places and look for this witness. That's the kind of showing that I think is expected or that we hope to see.
You know, Justice Rechtenwald, it's very clear in talking with you that you pretty much love your job. So share any thoughts or feelings you have about being the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Hawaii. That's really, unless you go to the Supreme Court at the federal level, this is like the top job.
For me, it's an incredible opportunity to engage in public service. And that's what I'm passionate about. Everyone, I think, needs to find the thing in life that they really care about. And for me, I found that what I care about is public service and trying to find ways to solve problems that exist in our community and trying to help people and help make their lives better. So for me, this job gives me the opportunity to do that in so, so many different ways. But I'm really honored to work with such a great team of folks at the judiciary. Chief Judge Ibarra is an amazing judge. He's going to retire in July, and that's going to be a huge loss for us. But I've learned so much from him. And so, you know, we really do have a group of people in the judiciary who care about our mission, which is providing justice. And what could be a better job to have when you show up in the morning than to provide justice in your community? And we have people who feel passionately about it, who really care, and who go the extra mile to try to do that every day and every opportunity they have. So to be part of this organization is just an incredible opportunity. I'm so grateful for it, and I try every day to see what can we do to do better, how can we improve, how can we meet the needs of our community in a more effective way. So I'm very, very grateful for this opportunity.
Justice Rechtenwald, you and many other people celebrated a great victory in 2016. I understand you're a Cubs fan.
That has been a lifelong, something I've waited a long, long time for. So I grew up in the Chicago area, went to Cubs games as a kid, went back to law school there, went to Cubs games then. And you know, when they finally won after all those years, I think a lot of people who are lifelong Cubs fans, I went up to Punch Bowl where my mom and dad are buried, and I went up there just to tell them that the team finally won. And that was a very special moment for me. And I think, you know, around Chicago, that scene has been played out a lot. And I think there are a lot of happy memories and wishing that those folks had been able to see it themselves. But also, you know, the bottom line is you look back and you think about it, all the people, all the fans over the years who cared so much about that team, and to finally have it happen is amazing.
Any final comments before we say aloha?
One thing I'd say, the promise of justice for all, I think, is fundamental to our democracy. And we have to be sure that we're delivering on that promise. So one of the things that we really have emphasized is something called access to justice. And that's in our civil legal system, where we have folks who can't afford a lawyer. You know, if you come into our family courts in divorce cases, I think almost two-thirds of the people, neither of them have an attorney to represent them. If you go into landlord-tenant court, overwhelmingly you'll find at least one of the parties doesn't have a lawyer. And for a non-lawyer to come into the judicial system and have to represent themselves, it can be daunting. We've talked about some of those terms today, what's expected of you, when you get a chance to tell your side of the story, how you tell it. Those are things that lawyers go to school for years to learn, and yet people who are not able to afford a lawyer have to, in essence, do it themselves. So what we've tried in Hawaii is to be very systematic in addressing the needs of those folks by getting additional funding for civil legal services providers like Legal Aid and other folks, by getting attorneys to volunteer to come into our courthouses to be able to provide brief advice and information to folks in the community who are representing themselves. We've opened self-help centers here in our courthouse in this building and in Hilo. They've been among the most heavily used in our state. So we have folks from the West Hawaii Bar and the Hawaii County Bar who staff those centers a couple days a week. People come in, are able to at least talk to a lawyer briefly, get some orientation as to what they need to do to tell their side of the story. Here on this side, I think we had many hundreds of people who've come in. I think it's more than 500 people in a year who come into that center to take advantage of that resource. Couldn't do it without the bar. And then we're trying to do more online. So we've developed forms online, like a TurboTax kind of form. People can go online and get a court form filled out for them just by answering common sense questions. We've rolled that out into our libraries, so the software is available in libraries across the state. And now we're having attorneys do pro bono work over the internet, so people can log on to something called Hawaii Online Pro Bono, ask a question, and attorneys can then pick those questions and answer them. So we have a great coordinated effort across the state, and it's really making a difference. We were recognized as being the number three state in the country for our efforts to address access to justice just last year. And we just received a grant for $100,000 from a national foundation to plan how to take all of these steps that I mentioned and move them even further forward. So we have a lot of great things going on, great partnerships with our Bar Association, both on the state level, locally, and with the legislature. And I want to mention Representative Cliff Tsuji, who was a great legislator and a great supporter of our access to justice efforts. He came every year when we had ceremonies recognizing the lawyers who volunteer their time. He came to recognize them both in Hilo and on Oahu. He's going to be greatly missed, but one of his legacies is going to be his support for access to justice.
This has been excellent. Thank you so much, Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwald. Aloha.
Thank you so much, Sherry, and thank you to your listeners. I really appreciate having this opportunity to share what we do.
And of course, thank you so much to our listeners for being with us. This is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues when we get updates on our volcanoes. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahoi ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.